Well, welcome back to DougHammock.com, to our current podcast project on rethinking sex education. As you know, I try each week to post some thoughts here to help get a conversation going about creating a viable, a helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality, because what we've been doing hasn't been working. And I do hope you'll join in. I hope you'll comment either on the Facebook page or on the blog. And I do want to thank those who have, because at the end of this project, we're going to turn what we learned together into a book. And so let's get started. This week's episode is a follow-up on last. The title is Pornography Really a Problem? And this is part two. Now, in these two episodes, we've been looking to open up the conversation about porn, to open it up among ourselves and with our young people. Now, in the first episode, we talk about normalizing the conversation by discussing the parts of pornography that are not a problem. Now, in this episode, we're going to explore the parts that are. I was talking to a friend about the last episode, things that are not a problem with porn, and after listening a bit, she asked, "Now, what do you mean by porn, Doug? Because if you say that porn is the nude human form or sexual images or images that awaken erotic desire," she said, "well, then yes, things you say can apply. Because you're right, sex is not dirty. And you're right, erotic desire is hardwired into our brains. And I can see how we need to negotiate well between the upper and the lower brains. Okay, yeah, I've got that. But I don't think you're taking into account that porn isn't limited to the nude human form or sexual images. Some really awful things happen," she said, "under the heading porn. People act out and then watch rape fantasies. That's porn. Men urinate on women and vice versa. And that's porn too. Porn teaches our boys that no means yes and yes means anal. Doug, I don't think you've taken into account," she said, "a whole lot of things that are called porn, so that when you say what the problem is not, you haven't factored in those other things." And she's right. When it comes to porn, terms are kind of difficult to define. That was true way back in 1964 when the Supreme Court was wrestling with porn and with obscenity. And that's when one of the justices, Justice Stewart, introduced the phrase into our nation's shared vocabulary. "I don't know how to define it, but I know what it is when I see it." Now, he was acknowledging how difficult it is to create a clear distinction between what is obscene and what is beautiful. It's difficult to write a definition that separates out the loveliness of human physicality and the loveliness of human sexuality and the ugliness of obscenity. So, yes, what my friend said to me is true. Porn is more than beauty. Porn is more than nudity. Porn is more than images that evoke sexual desire. And it is in the moreness that porn really becomes a problem. Not for the reasons we cited in the last episode, but a problem nevertheless. Now, if you've been following the podcast, you may already have an inkling of where the problem lies. The framing premise of this project has been that the sexual journey is a richly layered, multi-dimensioned, transformative experience. It's a journey that can't be reduced merely to eroticism or erotic experience. It's bigger than that, deeper than that, more encompassing than that. So if anything reduces the five stages of the sexual journey down to eroticism, pornography will do it. If anything undercuts the timing required to form stable pair bonds, pornography will do it. If anything disregards the wholeness of both masculine and feminine sexuality, if anything undercuts best practices for sexual health and well-being, pornography will do it. So, as we're getting ready to have these conversations with our kids, let's look at the ways that porn really is a problem. As porn has become so completely accessible in our society, it's become a powerful force in shaping our collective sexual attitudes. It especially molds the minds of the young. It especially conditions how our young people think about and how they experience their sexuality. Often, our boys and our girls get their primary sexual instruction from pornography. And even if they don't see it personally, their peers do. So, when young people are exerting peer pressure on one another, the instincts and the attitudes that get picked up through these images are in the mix. Now, porn producers are not manufacturing their product with an eye to healthy sex for a lifetime. They don't depict sexuality unfolding according to the psycho-emotional processes that we've studied, nor do they create their product guided by the principles of health or longevity. No, the porn industry is organized around profit, which means two things. First, it's in the industry's best interest to focus exclusively on eroticism because the erotic is quick. The erotic is powerful. The erotic is evocative. The erotic is the perfect vehicle for capturing people's attention quickly and evoking their desire and then selling them stuff. Nobody pays $3.99 to watch a video of people working out pragma love. Young males aren't locked to their computer screen to watch a couple hammer out a conflict as they transcend your life and my life and do the hard work of creating our life. No, as we saw earlier, we sell stuff with eroticism. We sell stuff with push-up bras and six-pack abs because it works. Eroticism is the perfect medium for selling. Second, it's also in the porn industry's best interests to market to males. As we were exploring in the episodes on yin and yang sexuality, we realized that healthy sexuality honors both the masculine and the feminine, but porn isn't really targeted at the feminine sexual desire. Porn appeals to the masculine sexual preference. It arouses quickly and visually. These are both masculine sexual impulses. It doesn't depict the sexual relationship that unfolds over a long period of time. That's a feminine sexual impulse. In preparation for these episodes, I've spoken to a lot of parents, and the conversation about pornography goes like this. One mom was talking about how male-centric pornography really is. I mean, really, this mom says, is there a woman out there who really likes having semen ejaculated all over their face? I mean, who writes this stuff, she asked. I mean, who actually thinks it's fun for women to get involved in these activities? Porn's focus on masculine sexuality makes it a problem. It's a real problem, but not because it evokes sexual desire and not because sex is dirty. It's actually a problem that's worse than that. Porn is a problem of social devolution. Porn is a problem of devastated sexual intimacy. Porn is a problem of debasing women and debasing feminine sexuality, and it's a problem of derailing the sexual journey. So, to get ready to have these talks with our kids about porn, let's look at several of the harms that it causes us and will cause to our young people. First, pornography is too easy. There's a problem. Pornography is too easy. In the chapter on masturbation, we saw a dynamic that is doubly present with porn, and that is that if we isolate and overemphasize eroticism, if we detach it from the other stages of making love over a lifetime, we weaken the transformative power of the full sexual journey. This whole project has framed sexuality as a multifaceted, full-spectrum human experience, and when we reduce the whole to a part, we eviscerate its richness. By definition, that's exactly what pornography does. It separates eroticism from the other components of the sexual journey. When a stripped-down version of sex becomes the primary instruction for our young people, they pick up a way of being sexual that doesn't have the stamina or the transformative energy to give them full lives of sexual dynamism. The problem with porn is not that it's dirty. The problem with porn is that it's easy. Artificial, on-camera sex, that's easy. It strips out eroticism from relationship. It strips out the motivation to know and be known. It strips out the motivation to make love, to hammer out loving relationships that can last. Instead, our sexuality focuses on just getting off. In pornography, a supporting part of sexuality, when that becomes the main event, the only event, pornography is exclusively honoring the physical expression of intimacy. But when it does that, it skews and it distorts the message that we give ourselves and our young people. We buy into the idea that eroticism is the most important way to be sexual. But as we've seen, sexuality is much more robust than that. The human sexual journey involves a wide swath of our being. So we've seen that there is a high price of admission to experience the full sexual journey, and we've seen it's a price well worth paying, but it is hard work. The hard work of making love yields a lifetime of love, a lifetime of sexual fulfillment, a lifetime of transformative intimacy. It's a high price, but it also returns a high yield on our investment. So yes, the full sexual journey is difficult, but pornography is easy. Artificial sex consumed on a screen, that's easy. A steady diet of quick and easy orgasms is easy. But it also atrophies the internal musculature that is necessary for sustaining sexual relationships. So that's a problem with porn. It's just too easy. And it invites us into new and exciting erotic experiences without any of the hard work. It gives us easy orgasms without any commitment. We don't have to learn another person. We don't have to listen to another person. We don't have to develop our understanding or develop empathy for the different sexual tastes or the personality differences. We don't have to do any of the work that takes decades. We don't have to make love. And as our young boys consume this product that's tailored to their male sexual preference, they can achieve quick, easy, work-free orgasms that demand none of the hard work that's required for successful sexual relationships. And when they do, they get weak. The non-erotic parts of their sexuality atrophy. They fail to develop the skills that are required to make pragma love and philos love and agape love and to integrate those parts of the sexual journey. When porn divorces sexuality from relationship, it atrophies the relational skills that are required for lifetime sex. Pornography gives the primal brain what it needs without any fuss, without any muss, without the work, without the learning, without the knowing, without the changing, without the growing. And in the end, it delivers a sexual brain chemical rush and sets habit neurons deep into our brains, but it never forces us toward the relational skills that are necessary to live out the full journey. It also sets expectations for sexual experience that are demand-free, which in real life isn't the way sexuality goes. Porn makes the lesser point the main point. It makes the part the whole. And in the process, it damages our long-term well-being. It leaves us ill-prepared to have our deepest needs met. It leaves us undeveloped in the skills necessary for lifetimes of sexual fulfillment. Now, as we'll see in some later episodes on casual sexual encounters, the problem with porn is the problem with white bread. White bread gives us calories, takes care of what we need, but it doesn't give us the nutrients that will sustain us over a lifetime. It robs us of something deeply important and leaves us unskilled in the hard work demanded to love well. So, pornography helps us become sexual people without having to become relational people. Now, it's just true that men look at porn more than women do. And how often do we hear women complain about the relational retardedness of men? And how often are they right? Many men do not know how to love a woman. Many men are unskilled in the art of relationship. They know how to achieve an orgasm, but really, how great an accomplishment is that? It's pretty much a skill set that comes with the penis built right in. Porn will quench a raging erotic fire, but it does so without requiring very much of us. Now again, as important as erotic desire is, it's a subset desire. It's the servant of our deeper longing to love deeply. And when we atrophy our relational skills, porn divorces the erotic from the intimate, creates the notion that we are living with two distinct, separate experiences, the intimacy experience and the erotic experience. And when that is represented that way, it misrepresents the human experience. Porn's a problem. Second, porn distorts our sexual narratives. When we internalize the message that the erotic is what really matters, we give a lot more energy to being sexy and looking sexy and acting sexy and performing sexy gymnastics. And we end up chasing the blind hope against hope that our erotic pursuits will help us experience intimacy. But again, that's not the way it works. Back in the 70s, I was young, I was healthy, I was keenly focused on the erotic like most young males. And I was fortunate early on to stumble upon studies that connected sexuality and intimacy. And I learned back then that people have better erotic experience in the context of fully committed relationships. And I learned that building commitment into our sexual lives leads to better experiences of sex. Now, contrary to how things are usually presented in the media, old, boring, married people have more sex and have better sex and have more varied sex than people who are not. People in long-term committed relationships report significantly more satisfying sexual lives. Now, in the book, I'll put a footnote here. It's going to cite a study at the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University. You can Google the article title. It's called Want More and Better Sex? Get Married and Stay Married. But that's not our society's sexual narrative. We share a collective assumption that long-term relationship sex is tired and boring and infrequent and uninspired. Our culture's joke is that sex before commitment is great and sex after commitment is rare or dreary or uninteresting. And sure, in the context of long-term relationships, eroticism has to adapt to the demands of life. When life happens and budgets happen and kids and responsibilities happen, eroticism has to ebb and it has to flow. At certain times, other parts of love get more airtime than the erotic. But even as old, married people's sex ebbs and flows with time, the numbers don't bear out that it's a negative change. In fact, just the opposite. When we succeed in knowing and being known, when we succeed in developing intimacy, when we succeed in making our relationships work, we also work out how to make the erotic part of our love work as well to everybody's satisfaction. More fulfilling sex in the context of full sexual relationships, it's a thing. But again, that's not the story our society tells, and it's not the story that pornography tells. We tell a story about uncommitted sex being better. We tell a story about knowing and being known actually degrading eroticism. We tell a story in which once we honor the psychological and the emotional and the intimacy parts of the sexual journey, erotic fulfillment will somehow actually diminish, which is a distorted sexual story, but it is the story porn gives us. And once that's our story, who really wants to do all that hard work? If the hard work of relationship building makes sex worse, it makes sense that we should just use one another's bodies as orgasm apparatuses, apparati. If uncommitted sex is better, why pursue anything else? The hard reality of building life with someone is difficult. Deciding on a budget, helping each other stick to it, figuring out how to do grocery shopping, who's going to call the plumber, organize the babysitter. The part of making love that complements eroticism and builds something that lasts for a lifetime, this is difficult. So why do all that hard work if it actually makes erotic sex worse? Why bother? But it doesn't. Again, that's a distorted narrative. Now, it's a narrative that a lot of us carry. Porn distorts what we look for, consequently what we find. Porn distorts what we chase and what we leave unchased. So again, porn is a problem. First, one problem is that it's easy. But second, it distorts our sexual narrative. Third, porn distorts our sexual development. As we've said, sexuality unfolds best in an environment of loving, committed, learning relationships. But an excessive focus on the erotic diminishes that environment. When the whole game is about getting in bed, the time and the space and the instinct for relational building gets lost in the shuffle. When porn defines our expectations, we tend to disrespect the developmental parts of the sex journey. Young people prematurely jump into porn scenarios with one another and in the process learn much less about one another. Erotic focus crowds out an intimacy focus. It crowds out the skills necessary for developing relationship. The bandwidth of the system gets taken up without ever developing deep friendships. In 2011, psychologist Philip Zimbardo, he gave a TED Talk. The title of it was The Demise of Guys. In it, he talked about how many young men are failing to make it in society and especially in their intimate relationships. He cited many causal factors, one of which was the overuse of pornography. Pornography is so good at arousing our erotic desires that it displaces the time and energy that we spend pursuing other things that help us develop, particularly relationships between boys and girls. And this toxic combination of powerful arousal and low relational demand shapes our young men's developmental journeys. And they learn to ignore the demanding parts, the building, the growing parts of life skills. And they certainly fail to develop the friendship skills before they develop the skills in bed, which is a distorted sexual journey. It's a journey with very little place for conversation, for lingering eye contact, very little space for the process that unfolds during eye-to-eye, voice-to-voice, hand-to-hand that we saw earlier. Under the pressure of excessive erotic arousal, Zimbardo suggests that young boys fail to develop the skills they need in life. And our young men fail to develop the skills that will sustain their sexual relationships. Pornography awakens a voracious hunger for novelty. Like any powerful drive, the thrill of one kind of experience wears off pretty quickly. The same old pornography gets boring pretty quickly. In a sense, pornography acts like a drug. It releases reward chemicals, but after a while, our brains get accustomed to that dose of reward chemicals, and to experience the same reward, we need something more. So, the porn industry has to develop new products to up the thrill. Photographic images are replaced with video images. Video images then begin to showcase new kinds of scenarios, new and different kinds of bodies, more people, threesomes, foursomes, full-on orgies. And as each product evokes a diminished thrill, the industry has to develop more, newer, more thrilling varieties. So we have gang rape scenarios, domination and whips and chains, anal sex, sex hanging from the chandeliers. But there's a problem with the avaricious hunger for newness. It's going to eventually hit a limit. There are a finite number of ways for people to have sex. There are a lot of positions in the Kama Sutra, a lot of them, but it's a finite number. Sexual newness will eventually hit a dead end. And if sexual fulfillment is depending on newness, it's eventually going to run its course. Now, when our young people get on the newness train, they start down a path that is inevitably going to end poorly. When the spiritual journey is all about novel ways to hook up the plumbing, it distorts the process, it distorts the journey. It's not unlike how we eat together. Like sexual experiences, there are a finite number of foods. It's a big number, and there are a lot of ways to prepare foods, but the number is finite. When people eat together day after day for a lifetime, they eventually hit the limit of food newness. At some point, if newness defines goodness, then food will stop being good. But that's not how it usually goes. Usually we make this transition pretty seamlessly. At some point, our food fulfillment stops being about novelty and becomes about who we share the food with, who we share the meal with. That becomes just as important as the food itself. Again, that's a pretty normal process. But it's just as normal in the way that we experience sexual fulfillment. There is a lot of newness to discover together, years' worth. But the shift must inevitably happen from the newness of the experience to the sharedness of the experience. And that's a natural process that pornography distorts. By highlighting only a narrow part of sexuality, it produces sexuality with a limited shelf life. And when we hit the end of that run, we try to expand the novelty for a while, but eventually new and different just runs its course. Pornography is a problem. It's a problem because it distorts our sexual development. It's a problem because it's too easy. It's a problem because it distorts the sex stories that we tell. And it's a problem because it inhibits natural sexual development. Fourth, pornography invites addiction. Sexual experiences in general and pornography in particular triggers the same dopamine motivation cycle that we explored in the episode on masturbation. And, as we saw, the cycle is always subject to the power of addiction. I've spoken to a lot of people in 12-step groups for sex addiction. And they speak of the addictive power of pornography with the same gravity that other groups speak of drugs or alcohol. Now, others debate them on the claim, but this is their experience. Others think that dopamine doesn't have the same addictive properties as alcohol or cocaine. But no matter how that debate ends, it's clear from these people's experience that porn follows an addictive pattern. Porn produces chemicals in the brain that have the power to habituate us. any activity that produces motivation chemicals in our brains, that produces good feelings, that produces a high, will in turn produce desire to repeat that experience. And once those habits are formed, in order to produce the same level experience the next time, the stimulus has to be stronger. So that's why porn becomes an escalating cycle. To get the same good feelings, it requires more and better porn. That's just how our brains work. Whereas underwear models could once produce a thrill, now the same thrill requires nude photos. Acclimate to nude photos, and now we require video for the same level of excitement. Acclimate to video, now we have to escalate the video. Softcore becomes hardcore. Hardcore becomes multiple partners and porn and bondage and bestiality and so forth. 2008, a movie came out with Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Scarlett Johansson. The movie's called Don John. It explored the power of porn addiction to undercut relationship and real human sexual experience. It followed a young man's experience of both pornography and a relationship with a beautiful young woman. It was a study in how the power of the former so easily undercuts the fulfillment of the latter. So again, porn's too easy. That's a problem. Porn distorts our sex stories. That's a problem. Porn distorts our natural sexual development. That's a problem. And porn invites addiction. Number five, by targeting males, pornography skews sexuality. It's interesting to note that as the porn industry creates these newer and newer products to escalate the thrill, it's interesting to note how often these new products degrade women. One mom I spoke to said it this way. What woman actually likes getting on her knees to have her face ejaculated on? I really don't think, she speculated, it's women that are writing these scripts. Pornography honors yang sexuality and it dishonors yin. It doesn't emphasize intimacy or tenderness. It plays to male interests. And in the process, it often veers into scenarios that degrade women. Many young men learn their sexual attitudes from porn, and they in turn teach those attitudes to young women. It hasn't taken long for our young women to pick up the social message that they are defined by their desirability to men. Young girls are under a lot of pressure to give boys what boys want, what they learn to want watching porn. There's a lot of pressure on girls to live up to the images and the practices that shape boys' expectations. In a survey that was run by Plan International, young girls in Australia were asked about their experience of young boys, and they overwhelmingly reported a negative impact of porn on their emerging sexuality. You can Google the article. The title was, "Don't Send Me That Pic." 80% of them said that it was unacceptable for young boys to request nude images of them, but they also reported that the pressure to do so was part of their everyday interaction with boys. One young girl in the survey spoke for many when she described her first sexual experience. "It went okay, I guess. I think my body looked okay. He seemed to enjoy it." Her own experience didn't figure into her assessment. His did. Good sexual encounters are, for many young people, defined by the boy's enjoyment, not the girl's. Now, as porn focuses on, targets, boys and men, one of the consequences is a society-wide pressure on girls and women to perform pornographic sexual scenarios and to live up to the body images that boys regularly consume in porn and to live up to boys' expectations that have been shaped by porn. When our sexual attitudes are so shaped, girls can't help but absorb the message that their sexuality exists for the gratification of boys. In that same survey, an eighth grade girl was asked how she knew a boy liked her. "Well, if he still wants to talk to you after you give him oral sex," that was her answer. A high school girl reported a boy telling her, "I'll give you a kiss if you give me oral sex." A 15-year-old girl said that she tried to hurry through sex with her boyfriend so they would have time to sit on the couch and watch a movie. Porn-consuming boys become tutors for our young girls as they're shaping their sexual identities. The curriculum of this porn-shaped generation, it's skewed. It dishonors feminine sexuality. It honors masculine. So in the quest to keep selling to boys and to keep selling to men, each new product further skews sexuality toward the male. Every step further devalues and often even debases the sexual experiences of women. In another conversation I had putting this episode together, one woman told a story about a gender studies class that she had in college, and her professor brought up how pornographic images degrade women, and she showed some of those images in class. They were images that stood out this many years later for this woman. They were images of hog-tying women so that men could act out rape fantasies. And she said, is that supposed to be desirable? And that's what each new innovative product does. It further disenfranchises feminine sexuality by marketing to men. And eventually, sexuality devolves into scenarios that inflict pain on women. One woman told me about her child having seen images of women's breasts being tied up with a cord. They were misshapen and they were bruised as those cords cut into her flesh. And again, she asked, for whom is a woman in pain sexually desirable? That's what a male-targeted industry will do. By targeting males, the industry perpetuates the idea that girls' bodies exist for boys' pleasure. And if that fulfillment is violent, so be it. If it's degrading, so be it. That's what girls are supposed to do for boys. It's a girl's place. It's her role. And look at the movie. They like it. How sick is that? In a 2012 meta-study on several research projects that synthesized the research around internet porn, they studied the social acceptance of male dominance in sexual experiences. As porn normalizes women as sexual playthings that are eager to fulfill male sexual desires, we are exposing our young people to a form of sexual education that can't help but affect their underlying attitudes and shape the sexual journeys that they travel. Porn is a problem. In my conversations with parents and with women, with mothers in particular, there is a sense of rage that our culture would teach their sons such a distorted version of sexuality, that would teach them that somehow degrading women is acceptable. In that Australian survey that I mentioned a moment ago, there were some questions about bondage and about sadism and masochism. And as early as seventh grade, young girls were wondering if being tied up and hit meant that boys loved them. They'd absorbed the 50 shades to the place that they were toying with the assumption that somehow being demeaned, being disrespected, being struck somehow meant love. They had picked up the idea that playing a submissive role communicates to a boy that she loves him. Pornography teaches our young people a deep falseness about their sexuality. When it focuses only on male sexual instincts, it messes up the whole thing. When women end up dishonored, feminine sexual desire gets pushed out of the equation, and in the end, males end up having a less fulfilling sexual experience. Porn teaches our young people that a woman's role is to present herself for a man's taking and to enjoy it enough to have screaming orgasms in the process. That's what happens when a product is marketed to males. Control and dominance creep in. Extremes creep in. Binding and gagging women gets normalized. Women in pain gets associated with sexual pleasure. Violent sexual experiences get acted out in scenarios. Women are taught to enjoy ejaculate all over their faces. When an industry is as powerful as the porn industry gets to shape our sexual attitudes, and when its target audience is overwhelming male, distortions that normalize distorted sexuality, that disrespect and dishonor, these become our heritage. Porn is a problem. It's too easy. It distorts our sex stories. It distorts our natural sexual development. It invites addiction, and it skews our sexual attitude toward males. Finally, number six, pornography distorts our ideas about our bodies. Pornography is by no means the only media outlet that does this, but it is a commanding player in the game. Like television and film and magazine, porn preaches the gospel of the young and the firm body. It teaches the idea that good people, sexually desirable people, have larger than average breasts, larger than average penises. They certainly don't have stretch marks, and if they're lumpy in the wrong places, they somehow are less valuable. And raised on a steady diet of these images, real life gets to become kind of a letdown. People don't really look like that. porn broadcasts a powerfully unconscious message that sexual intimacy is reserved for people with the right kinds of bodies. In a group that I gathered to talk about sexuality, one woman spoke about growing up with the wrong kind of body. She had the wrong kind of body when she was high school, she said, and she never got asked out on dates. And then in college, she blossomed, and in her mind, she became acceptable to boys. But after all those years of being in the wrong kind of body, she was frightened of losing her newfound status as desirable. She wanted desperately to keep it. She decided to do whatever it took to keep it. And it turned out she ended up accommodating whatever any boy desired of her. I was an ugly duckling, she said, and once I turned into a swan, I never wanted to go back. And I felt like I hadn't been a valid person until I got pretty. I hadn't been a valid person until men wanted me. I hadn't been a valid person until I looked the way that men thought I should look. What a toxic message our porn-saturated society gives to our young girls. It's a toxic byproduct of porn's ubiquity that our girls are regularly ranked by their bodies. Everyone knows the standard, and everyone knows that the majority of women can't compete. Anyone with a normal body, with normal non-porn standards, ends up getting devalued. This isn't real sexuality. It's male-dominated distortion at its worst. Porn is a problem. It's a real problem. It's not a problem because sex is dirty. It's not a problem because erotic arousal is a problem. It's a problem because it undercuts the sexual journey. It trades the deepest desires of our hearts for quick and easy orgasms. It's a problem because it makes us relationally lazy and it atrophies our relationship-making skills. It's a problem because it skews our instincts and our desires and it replaces healthy desires with those that work against our long-term fulfillment. Porn is a problem. It's a problem because it promotes an agenda that's completely at odds with forming healthy sexual relationships. It works at odds with the way real sex and real love works out in real people's lives. Porn is a problem because it undercuts healthy relationships. It erodes equality and honesty and mutuality and respect. So what do we teach our kids about pornography? We teach them about the whole sexual journey. We teach them chapters 1 through 7. We teach them about the wisdom of timing. We teach them the episodes 15 through 17. We teach them about sexual practices that work and those that don't. We teach them episodes 18 and 19. We teach them the importance of embracing both the yin and the yang of sexual relationships. We teach them episodes 13 and 14. We teach them that pornography, while not a problem for some reasons, is a huge, huge damaging problem in their lives for others. And we teach them this by not avoiding the conversation, but by normalizing it and having it early and having it often. And I hope that the material that we've gathered in these two episodes helps those conversations happen. So tell me, what are you thinking? Got any questions, any comments, any thoughts? I would really love to hear. Comment on the blog itself or on the Facebook post about the blog. Next time, we'll pick up here.